with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarland, host of The Conversation with Al McFarland. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. Glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. Now, today is Veterans Day, November 11th, and I'm a veteran, so I want to take a minute to shout out all the men and women who have served in any of the military services of this country, and to those who think that that's one of the pathways that their sisters and brothers, sons and daughters could take. I was talking to my daughter this morning, Batala, and we were just talking about, it's really cool that in our family we talk to people about the possibility of military service. Now, that might be unpopular with many, but for me, even though my politics never aligned when I was on active duty during the Vietnam era, they never aligned with the politics of the nation. I have to separate that from the benefit of being in service, of learning, of growing. And so reflecting on the benefit of moving from being a young person, a student, to a grown person in the military, I value, I treasure the experience, and I recommend it. And I say this to Black people, to our people, people of color. You know, every place we can go to plant a flag for the advancement of our families and our cultures, we should do it. And the military, police department, government service are no exceptions. If we don't like what's happening in the public area, in the way things are being deployed, used, one of the strategies is to put ourselves in a position to make decisions for the use of service institutions and organizations. So with that, I again say to my people, to my family, and to you who are listening and watching, consider and appreciate military service as one of the ways that you can connect and exercise a sense of sovereignty, a sense of ownership in our culture, in our society. Well, also, we came off a wonderful, wonderful election last week, and I have a couple of people in the studio with me today to talk about the recent elections here in Minnesota and around the country. Corey Day is here. Corey, are you there? And Amanda Otero is here. Corey is a political strategist, so he's with Blue Ox Strategies. Amanda Otero is with Take Action Minnesota, both of whom eminently qualified to give us a rundown on what happened last week in Twin Cities. To begin with, though, what I'm seeing in social media and reading around the country is that the progressive movement showed up and showed out in a lot of places, and that the Democratic Party in general showed up in ways that surprised itself, but also maybe setting an expectation which is positive and necessary for the 2026 elections. First of all, Amanda and Corey, thank you guys both for being here. Amanda, let me start with you. Talk about what Take Action Minnesota is and what you do. And I want to get to where you give me sort of a rundown on what you think were victories here in Minnesota and what you think are victories in the country in the political landscape as we speak. Amanda.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. Amanda Otero, co-executive director at Take Action Minnesota. We are what we call a power organization. We exist to organize everyday Minnesotans around their self-interest, what they care about, what's at stake for them in community, and build, community and networks, and ultimately run campaigns, issue campaigns, and at times then also electoral campaigns to make those visions a reality. And we're, you know, really proud of the work we did this election. There's certainly a lot to talk about. We have teams of parents and caregivers organizing in the Twin Cities, performers organizing in the Twin Cities, a team of renters organizing up in Duluth, and a broad general membership that's about 13,000 strong across the state. And I think I'll just start off by saying one of the things that we're proudest of from this election day actually comes out of Duluth. Our team up there, Duluth Tenants, ran a ballot initiative campaign for a renter's right to repair, and it won in a landslide. And so renters starting in the new year in Duluth will be able to make small common sense repairs for their rental properties and then deduct those repairs from their rent if their landlord has not responded to them about repairs in 14 days. And so we're very excited about that like practical solution being put in the hands of people.
Corey, what are your first impressions about last week's elections? You supported, the Thrive campaign, which is, I would call it, describe it, the center Democratic Party. Give us a rundown. What was the overall sense of how the elections came out from your point of view?
Well, I'll start kind of on more of the national sense. I think we should be extremely happy with the turnout that we saw nationally, that what we saw in Virginia, New Jersey, in Georgia, in California. We should be, you know, we're on a good path right now. Democrats are fired up. They're turning out. Independents are starting to really look at this administration and this president. They're seeing the fact that their lives are not getting better. And we saw that at the ballot boxes last Tuesday. So that was a really good place to be going into a midterm, that our folks are really fired up and really excited about what's going on out there with the Democratic Party and some of our candidates. So I was really excited for my good friend, Chairman Ken Martin. I thought he did a wonderful job really getting out there around the country and firing up Democrats all over, from the state legislative races to those governor's races. Here in Minnesota, I was really excited to see Mayor Frey's reelection. You know, I think, you know, he laid out the case very well, why he deserves four more years. And, you know, I think the voters came out and they saw that. I thought the council races were very interesting. We have a weird balance when it comes to kind of the centrist moderate and kind of the more progressive left. You know, we'll see how that looks come January when they swear in a new council president and they all kind of get sworn in and see how that looks. But for the most part, I was really happy. Pearl Warren and Ward 5, she's going to be a wonderful council member there. You know, we got Elizabeth Schaefer in 7. So I was really excited about some of the new members. I'm excited that folks are kind of, you know, taking a step back and are going to find a way to work together come next year, realizing that the only way we're going to move this city forward is if they all get on the same page when it comes to policy. And how can we figure out a way to that we can all see the best way to move Minneapolis forward. And then obviously we had the election in St. Paul with a new mayor coming in, which, you know, still kind of figuring that piece out a little bit. But, you know, Mayor Hurd is going to be wonderful. She's a smart candidate. She ran a very strong campaign. She didn't have a whole lot of time on the ground. And, you know, she was able to get out there and get her voters out. So, you know, she earned 4 years. So we'll see how that goes.
Amanda, any thoughts about the mayoral campaigns in both cities?
Yeah, absolutely. Our member leaders endorsed Senator Omar Fateh very early on this year with a clear vision around, you know, some of the changes that they wanted to see in the city moving forward, and a real belief that Senator Fateh could be the person to deliver those changes. And, you know, obviously the results are not what we had hoped, and we're disappointed about that loss. You know, we endorsed Senator Fateh early on because we know, you know, our members really know that they deserve safe and stable homes and affordable childcare and livable wages and schools that support our students and educators. You know, some of the issues that, like I, you know, in our example up in Duluth that we actually took to the ballot and put on the ballot, you know, and it feels like the last 8 years in Minneapolis, you know, as someone who lives in South Minneapolis, we've from my perspective, really lacked the kind of leadership to deliver what folks are really needing right now. And so that loss is disappointing, but at the same time, really agree with what you all have spoken to in terms of, you know, turnout and the energy and the base. I mean, we really saw it and felt it throughout this whole year. Our members showed up big time, knocking over 16,000 doors for Senator Fateh's campaign and for our endorsed council candidates, and felt, you know, just people use the word electric to describe the campaign events and door knocks and fundraisers. Just a lot of hope and vision for what can be possible. And that piece, those conversations on the doors, the members taking on leadership, and that feeling of hope and vision, you know, that doesn't go away after the loss. And so we're hopeful about what more we can do and build moving forward. I will say in terms of St. Paul, we did not screen and endorse in that race. And I will say, you know, I was surprised by the result, but I'm looking forward to see, what Mayor-elect her, you know, does in her leadership of St. Paul, and certainly have appreciated her leadership up at the Capitol.
Jonathan Palmer has joined us. Jonathan's a regular partner of mine here on The Conversation. Jonathan, how you doing, my friend?
Doing pretty good, Al. Great to see you and to see Corey again. And Amanda, I've met you, but I really like the work that your organization does.
Well, weigh in, Jonathan, on the election. Well, I know you are an avid advocate for civic engagement, for political empowerment, and you play close attention. I'd love to have your thoughts on both the mayor contest and the city council contest locally. But as Corey and Amanda have done, talk about the general flow for Democrats across the country and what that holds for the next election cycle. What are your thoughts, Jonathan?
Well, I think one of the best things is the level of civic engagement, which seems to be increasing. And that's really important. I think that's the issue we saw in 2024 in the national level. And so I think people are recognizing not only do they have the opportunity to get engaged, but they need to get engaged. Looking at the mayoral races, I think it's been interesting. I saw a lot of energy on both sides during the Minneapolis race. And I know there was, maybe some controversy around the endorsement convention, but it was a big, hard-won race for Minneapolis with Fryer winning another seat. But I hear Amanda, in terms of what her people were doing and out and door knocking around that. And I was also surprised about the results over in St. Paul. But, I've known her at the where she's been in the legislature, looking forward to seeing what can happen in the city. I was a big supporter of Melvin Carter's. So not the election result I had hoped for, but everybody's got to take a chance on, seeing what happens. I think what's also very good is the historic positioning that Mayor Herr has got, as the first South Asian person, and as well as I believe the first female mayor in St. Paul's history. So,
I think she's going to be the first person with an all female city council, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that is true as well. So there's a lot of historic precedents being set right there. And so that alone is something that's very significant and deserves to be recognized. And we've seen some good energy come out of St. Paul's City Council with that. I think anytime we can increase diversity within elected offices, that's a good thing. And it's something that expands out, and we can see people who have not always been allowed at the table, once they're at the table, they do a lot of great things and make things better. Looking at the same thing at the national level, we have Virginia, New Jersey, first woman governor of Virginia. To have the New Jersey and the Virginia two elected candidates were roommates on Capitol Hill when they first got there, and they've had a friendship. So it's even more significant that both of them won around that. And then Mamdani in New York is, I think, groundbreaking. One of the things that I think the Democratic Party has needed for a while has been a new energy and a new idea of focusing on progressives. The progressive people, Jasmine Crockett, AOC, they have been doing a lot of work that needs to be done and saying what needs to be said. And I think it's something that'll be a nice shot in the arm for the Democratic Party. And hopefully they follow that direction. I know there's now some controversy coming out of this deal that was made with the last minute, and seeing what will happen with Chuck Schumer, if he is going to stay in the leadership position. But when you talk about a blue wave coming through last week, I think it was incredible. I think it's a wake-up call for both parties. I think for the GOP, it lets them know things aren't going to just roll over like they thought it would be. And I think for the Democrats, it's see what happens when you work with progressives. See what happens when you focus in on the new energy. And we've got to look towards the younger people and generations to come up and build on that. Allow them to have the chance to move forward with their.
Corey, jump in on that. The national, the debate right now over the Senate Democrats, eight Democrats decided to go with the Republicans to allow the budget impasse to come to an end. Talk about, describe the dynamics, if you would, and kind of what's at stake, and what do you think the reasoning was by the leadership in the party, but also there's a lot of blowback coming from progressives who think that it represented a wholesale sellout, lack of backbone by the leadership in the Democratic Party. And who's getting dragged is both Schumer, but also the leader in the House. Talk about that, describe the dynamics there.
Yeah, I mean, there was always a certain element of senators who were always a little uneasy with all of this. You know, Fetterman, he was already, you know, against the government shutdown already. So they had four votes kind of already from the beginning of this. So they only had to turn a few more votes over. I think what you saw here, obviously, when it came to the SNAP benefits and other things that were coming down, I think you saw the fact that we're going coming into a holiday, Thanksgiving. We knew travel was going to get even more messy. You know, I think that was the thought process of those senators. And you look like Kane, who represents Virginia, obviously, that's where a lot of those government workers live in Virginia. So I'm sure he was hearing things. But overall, I do believe, you know, we were in a position of power right now when it came to this shutdown, when it came to really making sure that we got a better deal from the Republicans. And I think we should have held on a little longer. I think that, you know, it's one of those deals where I understand where those senators were coming from. But all in all, you know, there's just so much at stake right now. And coming off of Tuesday, coming off of kind of seeing where the public is when it comes to this administration and some of the decisions they're making, this was the time for us to push and to press. And you see our senators in this state and our congressional delegation all, you know, would vote against this deal. You know, I don't think it was a good deal. I think we definitely could have got more out of this. But I understand where those senators are coming from, because there are folks that are hurting right now. And we do want to make sure that we're finding a way to take care of these folks. I'm not going to pretend to know how some, you know, when it comes to your SNAP benefits or these folks who are working for the government who haven't been paid. You know, there are some struggles, but where this is the time now when it comes to this administration that we have to take a stand. We have to be strong on some of these issues. And I really wish that our Senate was strong. Now, the House, Akeem, no House members have broken. So I don't want to put it on Brother Akeem yet, because the reality is this is the Senate Dems, not the House Dems. And
he's getting dragged already, though.
But the House Dems have held a line so far on this. He's held his caucus together thus far. It's Schumer who hasn't had the ability to keep his caucus together. And to what Jonathan was saying earlier and kind of alluded to, there's definitely going to be some hoorah when it comes to Schumer and his position in leadership. And I think you're going to see a louder cry, not just from progressives, but either from more the moderate wing of the Senate, that there's need for new leadership there. But this was one of those deals that, this was our time to hold the line, to really make sure that if we were going to get a deal here, because the public was looking at this as a Republican shutdown, that we should have really made sure that we got more out of this than that, that they did from the deal they made with the Republicans, those eight senators.
Amanda Otero, I see you nodding. Weigh in on this from the position that you occupy, I'd say in the progressive spectrum. How did this undoing or take, look to you? And what's your comment on the whole national situation?
I mean, there is a lot at stake right now. And I mean, we all feel it. Our members feel it. You know, I'm in conversations with our members every day. You know, people were struggling, you know, struggling to figure out what to do without SNAP benefits. You know, in our organizing, I watch people, you know, switch shifts to be able to be in the organizing work and get childcare coverage and, you know, really like take a lot of leadership to be able to do the organizing work in community. And that's the kind of leadership that we want to see from our elected officials. And, you know, I'm not that person up on Capitol Hill. That's not the role that I play. And yet, like, I want to see them fighting as much as we're fighting on the ground. And that just, I feel, really remains to be seen. And I hear this from our members every day, the disappointment and the sense of hopelessness. If those folks aren't standing up for us now with everything at stake, as you're saying, Corey, this is the time to stand up to this administration. You know, it's disappointing and it's concerning. And you know, we'll continue to do the work that we're doing on the ground. And part of that is, you know, calling on our elected officials to really hold the line here. And thinking about, you know, even from our own perspective, right, the loss of our candidate for mayor in Minneapolis, across the board, we're going to continue to demand leadership that protects and invests in all of our neighbors, no matter who you are, no matter what kind of job you have, no matter where you live, how old you are, because that is the kind of leadership we need. And there's a real crisis, you know, I would say, collectively at every level of government in our communities of that leadership. And that's really the work that Take Action Minnesota does, is to build and develop leadership in our community members so that we can take, you know, take on those roles and take on those issues and problems and chart paths forward.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland, and talking with Jonathan Palmer is here, Amanda Otero and Corey Day. We're talking about politics, the current watching of what's happening in the Senate and in the House around the budget, but also reviewing what happened last week here in Twin Cities and around the country. If you want to be part of the conversation, we're streaming live to YouTube and to LinkedIn and to Facebook. And if you're on any of those platforms, drop a note in the comment. We'll try to shout you out and respond to you. I see our friend, the Big Cheese, has signed on with a comment or two. One, a comment about Minnesota from his point of view. I think he's in Texas, and he says, Twin Cities has a leftist, liberal, and undercover racist folks that control these politicians. Anybody want to respond to that? That's one perception. I'm sure you've heard that before. And he also says, I didn't know this, he's from Minneapolis, so he knows the deal. Say more, Big Cheese. What do you know that we should know? I'm glad you're here, glad you're watching and contributing. But respond to that. What on the ground, Jonathan and Corey and Amanda, are people feeling about the political processes? Like, so what I've been hearing on the social media that I watch is an utter disgust, for example, with the Democratic leadership about caving in to the Republicans. And the allegation is that, you know, this is a political craftsmanship to Chuck Schumer and the eight that went over to support the Republican agenda. You know, it's a question of theater. It's a dance. You know, it's choreographed. And it's a way to make something happen, to stop something from happening, but to give cover to everybody else. And so the question is, are our political leaders, people we elected, being sincere, genuine, authentic, and open, or are we being manipulated, handled even by our own people, and in a way that some will say is against our interests? Corey, what do you think? And anybody, jump in. Amanda, Jonathan, just open question.
Yeah, you know, I would just say we're just at norms are out of the window. And I think we're at a different time, at a time that, you know, I've never seen before when it comes to our politics, our national politics, where we have an administration that doesn't play by any rules, does not care what the courts say. They are openly racist. They're just playing an entirely different game. And I think what we need to do as citizens, as a party, as independents, wherever you are, if you're not with this administration, is that we got to realize you got to fight fire with fire, because we're playing against an administration and a side where they believe in ICE officers on our streets and the National Guard is patrolling, American cities. There is there are no more norms. There aren't even Republicans anymore. They're just MAGA. So I think what our side has to do, and I see some folks are trying to figure it out. We see the governor in California is starting to try to figure out different ways to really go after this administration, realizing that, you know what, we're not going to win here if we're bringing, but we don't win here with a knife at a gunfight. We have to actually fight fire with fire when it comes to redistricting or any of these things that this administration is doing the way that they're treating our citizens. So I'm hoping that our leaders in Congress understand that those old norms don't exist anymore. Those old good old buddies in the Senate having a late night drink and figuring things out and having a conversation and working through things, those days are gone. Those days are left with Tip O'Neill, and those days ain't coming back for some years. This is a different Congress. This is a different country. And we have to figure out and fight fire with fire and understand that the other side is never going to play fair. And they play by an entirely different set of rules. And we have to learn how to play by those rules and understand the new landscape that we're in.
Corey, you can't just drop Tip O'Neill into the conversation like that. Like, come on, that's a callback for us older folks. I agree with Corey. And I want to say, a little bit more around the rumor of the orchestration. Chuck Schumer is responsible for that he got the retiring Democrats to do that and was trying to play both sides. And it's looking like it's going to backfire.
What do you mean? How so?
Well, because the whole idea behind that was that we would be able to get something out of this. He could play both sides. He get the people seeing the Democrats still standing strong, but at the same time, a part of them went to make sure that the shutdown ended and funding would go back to, SNAP and things like that. The problem that we have is, as Corey said, we don't know what's going to happen. So we're going forward with this idea that there's going to be a vote in December on the ACA. And so this is okay to go ahead, and they've struck some sort of deal. We have a person in the Oval Office who has been sending out executive orders left and right. Any kind of thing could come out of that would tank even this, what I think is a bad deal that came out of it. So the more that we are able to hold the line, the more that we were able to take any advantage we have and exploit that and utilize that. I don't think we should have given up on the shutdown. I know that families were hurting, but I know that the nonprofit community had risen up and was doing the things to help manage that. I know they still were hurting and they were going to struggle with more of that, but we're going to be struggling in January. We're going to be struggling when these ACA does not come through. We have too much at stake to give any ground on this, and we've got to keep moving ahead and moving ahead hard. And I think for me, authentic leaders like Jasmine Crockett, like AOC, and Bernie Sanders has been doing a lot. He's not even in the party, but he's been, helping to electrify a lot of the energy. We've got to get people to pay attention to what's going on in their community and to be on the ground, volunteer with their campaigns, volunteer with organizations like Take Action, and be ready to move forward with a progressive agenda. We can't do things in the Tip O'Neill days. Corey is right. It's not that kind of world anymore. And so we have to prepare for a different kind of world and fight in that framework.
So, Amanda, what kind of world is it that we're moving into? It seems to me this opens the door to understanding the place that you're organizing from. New voices, new people, new issues, new approaches, new alliances. That's what I see in your work and your umbrella. What do you think?
That's right. Yeah, I think, Take Action Minnesota is almost 20 years old. We've been a lot of different things in those two decades. And right now, our membership is often the folks who are feeling left out of politics, who have been historically marginalized and are also feeling marginalized now for different reasons, including not seeing themselves in the sort of national Democratic Party, you know, kind of direction and the kind of, you know, this the leadership or lack thereof that we're talking about right now in DC. And our approach to that has been, again, about leadership. We all can be leaders in our community. And so what is it that we need to do? How do we need to build with our neighbors? How do we care for each other? How do we keep us safe? Jonathan, what you're speaking to in terms of nonprofits stepping up around SNAP, seeing mutual aid networks, neighbors just, you know, getting it together on their Buy Nothing groups to support folks in community. Like that's, you know, we do that. We've done that throughout all of history, right? Our people have done that throughout all of history. And so, you know, I think there's a real shift happening. And again, this is what I really felt in the Minneapolis election, as well as in the work up in Duluth, of people taking responsibility, no matter, you know, what official elected or appointed leaders are doing. And, you know, that's not going to be enough. We need those elected and appointed leaders to hold the line and to stand up. But the way, you know, for us to move them into that place is by doing the organizing and building the power that can, you know, call on them and hold them accountable to really having our communities' backs in those halls of power.
You know, in my, again, social media circles, the critique of Bernie Sanders was that his analysis, his frame of reference was economics, and his framework did not address the impact of race and white supremacist thought in our culture, in our society. But given that, in the past few days, I'm hearing some of those same voices happy that he stepped forward in the way that he has in the past 48 hours, decrying the action at the Senate and laying that at the feet of the leadership. Is there a way for Bernie to become more relevant in the Black community, or is Bernie not our solution? Corey, what do you think? I mean, am I correct in describing a hesitation and a disappointment in the Black community, the Black voters around Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of those things, you know, I think for Bernie, you know, he's always been talking about these populist issues. I mean, this has been his song, you know, he's been playing off of this song card for years. I think maybe the party's kind of catching up with him a little bit when it comes to these issues that are very critical to him, that have been very important to him. You know, I think some of when it comes to Bernie and when it comes to voters of color, you know, younger folks like Bernie. I mean, this is definitely, well, this might even be more of a generational thing than it is just a kind of a person of color thing. Because when you talk to the big mics of the world and kind of those younger generation of, you know, African-Americans and Latino brothers, they're, you know, Bernie does, he does well with that generation. That younger generation. I think when it comes to an older generation, you know, we get caught up, and it's the truth, you know, we hear the word socialist and we're immediately turned off, right? I mean, it's just the reality of it, that if you're over 35 years old, you're 40 years old, you equate socialist with Cuba, you equate with something, all the things that we grew up in, we saw how we saw socialism. And then we equate socialism being the opposite of capitalism, being, well, you know, it isn't about folks kind of getting their own, you know, earning their own money, doing their thing, you know, hard work, and then, you know, taking that hard work and building from it. So mm-hmm. I think that is going to be always the piece that always hurt Bernie. It's the same piece in New York when you look at kind of the vote share of how that looked, because that is very much generational also. Is going to always be, and I do believe, within the Democratic Party, within the base Democratic voters, and you probably, and you saw it here in Minneapolis, I mean, you know, Omar didn't win one precinct in North Minneapolis, and the reason is going to be, as long as that word socialist is tied to some of these Democratic Socialist candidates, then you're always going to have issues with folks who are an older generation, and I think that's why Bernie doesn't do well.
You know, what I'll say is that I think gone are the days of finding a candidate that represents every single issue you have. And I think that's one of the places where people get tied up, is they have somebody who represents three of their four issues, but that fourth one, because they don't, now they're terrible as a candidate. And Bernie is not by any means perfect. And actually, when Bernie first came on the scene, I couldn't stand Bernie because the Bernie bros and everything that went with that. What I appreciate about Bernie is the fact that, one, he talks about what is going on with the 1%, and he talks about where taxi needs to be, and that he's partnered with AOC, so he's reaching down to a younger generation. There's definitely pieces that are missing from what he does and how Black voices and Brown voices need to be represented and heard, and I don't know that Bernie can ever speak to that. But I think he can work with people who can speak to that. I think that a lot of the issues we're seeing on the national level don't always trickle down to the local level. And we focus in on the local level a lot because that's where we see everyday issues being affecting us, except for when you have things like SNAP. So you can't put it in one category or the other. You know, on the local level, there's a lot of things that are going on that are helping communities and helping citizens on an everyday life with Minneapolis and St. Paul. You know, I'm doing some work with Neighborhood Development Center with the Minnesota Promise Act. It's helping small businesses get grants and go ahead and help grow their businesses. There's efforts around, I think the Big Cheese mentioned something about, we said nothing about bringing gainful employment to the community. That is a very important and essential issue. And so you have people who talk about it at the national level, but once you get down to the state level and you get down to the local level, the national, it doesn't really matter. It's what is your city doing? What is your state doing in terms of employment programs, in terms of going ahead and making sure that there's funding in the community to ensure that people can get jobs? It's the summer jobs with the different programs that work with that. So it's how far do you want to parse an issue? You know, there's the big categories you can talk about, but once you get down to the granular level, you've got to have people and organizations on the ground. And again, I'm going to go back to the nonprofit community, because that's where I see a lot of the work being done. And cities partner with the nonprofit community, businesses profit with the nonprofit community. And during the pandemic, it was the nonprofit community that really saved everybody. There wouldn't have been food for people if it hadn't been for the nonprofit organizations that had food shelves and were delivering that out and doing vaccinations and things like that. So I don't think the nonprofit community gets a lot of a credit for what it does. That's why I keep mentioning them. But the work has to be done by everybody. There is nobody who can solve everybody's problems. There's no Superman that's going to come in and swoop in and save the day, unfortunately. So you need a Barack Obama at the national level, and then you need senators like Tina Smith, like Amy Klobuchar. You need representatives that are working on the ground level. Our local representative over here in St. Paul is wonderful. And doing all that kind of work is what we need to be able to do.
Amanda, looking at the arc of engagement demographics profile and looking at the Minneapolis city mayor's race, for example, the feeling I had, I suspected and believed that Jacob Fry would win. But what I also believe is that this may be the last time that coalition is going to be able to deliver in the way that it's delivered presently and in the past, and that the Omar Fatta showing was massive and impressive, formidable, and that it's kind of like the handwriting on the wall. Unless something else happens that burns him out, and maybe you take it not so much on the person, but the position, the point of view, and that's a democratic socialist movement, as it's calling itself, is emerging. What do you see as the future? So Jacob is there. What's going to happen the next time around? What do you think?
You know, I have heard from so many members in the last week that they are fired up and ready to go. And some of that is what's at stake on a national level. And some of that is the like beauty and power that people felt in, again, having something that they were working for that they believed in. And, you know, we're not done. And many, many, many folks in Minneapolis who supported Senator Fateh or the Reverend Dr. Dwayne Davis or Jazz Hampton, we're not done. And so the, you know, the work continues. And I really agree. I think in another 4 years, you know, I'm certainly committed to continuing to build that movement. You know, we'll see who the candidates are, but that movement that can, yeah, they can bring a different kind of vision and set of solutions to our city. You know, I think this conversation about the word socialism, I really appreciate it. And it, you know, I, in the last 5 years, you know, our membership has gotten much younger. You know, we used to have a lot of older folks, and we still do. We're intergenerational, but we have a lot of young folks, you know, in their 20s and their 30s. I tend to be on the older side of our staff. And you know, we, as an organization, you know, we can't be all things and hold all things. And it's been an intentional choice to move in that direction, because that is the future, right? We often, you know, we can say that cliche, you know, the children, the young people are our future, but that is, you know, the reality. And so going and building with that momentum, I think, is a really critical role for us to play in this ecosystem. You know, I just wanted to say, Corey, what you were sharing about, you know, older Black folks and the reaction to the word socialism. My dad is an immigrant from Mexico. You know, he's almost 70 years old. He's been in the U.S. for 40 years now. And I was talking with him Sunday night, and he brought up, you know, he was really honing in on the democratic socialist and how that was the word that sort of, you know, stirred things up and made things challenging in this election. And his take, you know, when I grew up, my mom is from Nicaragua, and I grew up in a household with a lot of feelings about socialism. And my dad, you know, was Saturday night saying to me, well, but people should recognize that the, you know, the bailouts and the handouts to corporations and the way that corporations operate, mm-hmm. that's socialism for those corporations. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's just a little anecdote from my own, you know, family and experience, but I think it's really interesting to be having those conversations. And I do think that is, I mean, Jonathan, as you were saying, you know, the sort of 1% framing that Bernie Sanders offers, I think is becoming, you know, more and more resonant with even more people beyond just the youngest of folks, because we are actively seeing the role that corporations are playing in our politics. And so we look at the, you know, the inaction or the lack of leadership in DC, and we look at the Democrats and we say, what's the corporate money behind them? We look at the millions of dollars in corporate money poured into this election in Minneapolis, which, you know, the receipts are there. You can look at the campaign finance reports, and people are fed up with that. We don't want corporations buying our elections and crafting their solutions to our problems. And so I think there's a lot of potential there for that momentum and movement to continue to build and to complicate, you know, to complicate or to have the deeper conversation about what is it that we mean when we say democratic socialist, and what can that mean for our communities and our futures.
So Corey, if you would describe how that played out on the Minneapolis City Council, the progressive element that still, after this election, has kind of a one vote majority on 13 member council, if I'm correct, and what that means for the mayor, who yeah. we are describing as centrist, right? Yeah. And what are the dynamics? Where do the policy fault lines show up? What do the progressive want that the mayor wants a different strategy and approach, and vice versa?
I laugh when we talk about Jacob, because in any other conversation, in any other—
He'd be progressive.
A lefty's leftist.
Yeah.
And there's no Republican in this state that does not look at Jacob Frey and think that he's a total leftist. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting when you have the conversation within the Minneapolis City Council. You know, I think what it just really comes down to Al, is that and you got to look at it as a council. I just believe the way they operate, the kind of the more centrist kind of ring of the council and the more of the progressive side of the council just have not seen eye to eye on some of these key issues. And that's just the reality of it. I mean, and to Amanda's point, you can call it corporate money, whatever it might be, but, you know, there's going to be a different vision on rent control. And that's just the real. There was a different vision on labor standards board. I just think there's just a reality that one half of our council has a different vision of how to move this city forward than the other does. There's, I mean, obviously there are some issues that they're all going to come together on, that they all can agree on, that you're going to see majorities on the council and the mayor's not going to veto and things are great. But I think there's just all in all, and you're going to really see it play out in a very interesting way when this new council is sworn in, that they just have a principled different belief on how to move Minneapolis forward. And it's not just one issue or this issue, but they just principally believe Michael Rainville has a very, very different belief than Jason Chavez. That is just reality. Their politics is, you know, they're both Democrats and they're both going to, when it come November, they're going to, you know, tap the same person when it usually comes down to a general election. But the way they operate and the way they work with business or community or nonprofits is just different. And their visions are a little different. And what they have to understand coming next year, looking at a city that we're trying to recover, we're still trying to recover from COVID, we're still trying to recover from Florida. This city is, we're on the cusp. And the reality of it is that if these folks do not learn to work together, then we're all going to fall together. We have to. So our hope is that come, you know, Jan, when they swear, get sworn in, the progressives and the centrists figure out a way when it comes to these core issues of downtown. They're going to have to deal with a stadium probably at some point. There's going to be some very core issues that these folks are all need to come together and really work together and get things figured out. And it can't just be, you know, if Jacob's for it, I'm against it. Because I do believe that philosophy did take over a little bit over that city council for the last few years. And they cannot go into next year with that kind of philosophy, because that philosophy just hurts all of us who live in this city.
And so a result of that was action on the council limiting and overriding vetoes of the mayor, but also seeking to limit discretions and powers that his office had. So is this more of something that reflects just the nature of tension between the executive and the legislative session of the city? Is that?
I mean, look, I'll just throw this out. I mean, look, when Jackie Cherry Holmes was the city council president and Terrence Ellis Button was the mayor, they got together, they worked together. They got things done. They were a partnership. Things in this city was moving forward. Some people might not agree with everything or disagree with it, but the reality of it is that and at that point, the council was stronger than the mayor's office for the most part. It was before the strong mayor initiative. So the folks can work together. Things can come together, right? I mean, we've done it. RT figured out a way to do it. Betsy figured out a way to do it. We just have to get to a point where, you know, the city comes first and not some of our petty differences. So, and it really is. And I'm not even going to, I mean, I will say it is clear as I can, there is just some really, really petty differences that existed the last few years in the council, in the mayor's office, that really need to go away. And my philosophy this whole election was, you know, do the grown-ups need to take over? And my hope is that the grown-ups are at the table come next year and we figure out how to move the city forward and get some of the basic things done, George Floyd Square, things like that, that have been literally sitting on the shelves for over a year now, that we need to figure out and get these things done.
I think part of the issue that we're facing is really understanding what it means to be progressive, what it means to be socialist or democratic socialist, and the different ideas. And earlier, Al, you were talking about how the Black community feels about some of the parties and some of the pieces that are there in terms of who's in control. And a lot of that comes back to, you know, the systems that we're within. You know, we were raised thinking capitalism is a great system. And capitalism works really great if you have money. It doesn't work really great if you don't have money. It doesn't work really great if you're in the bottom tiers. Socialism has been branded as this evil word, but it's worked so well in many countries in Europe. And you talk about, you know, universal health care, and you talk about universal basic education and basic income. The things that we talk about being great that could help everybody somehow get branded as bad things because it's taking money away from somebody at a higher tier. We have a system that has grown out of slavery in America that built itself out of that. And it's something we forget when we start talking about how the systems exist here and the divisions and pieces. But there's a root in that, in systemic racism. There's a root in many of the way we have misogyny built into our society, homophobia. There, you can go down all the list of them. But all those pieces that have become part of systems where people cannot get jobs, people cannot get business loans, people cannot get financing in a certain area. Those are the pieces that need to really be deconstructed. Those are the ones that we need to take apart. And Corey's right about petty differences, and that's part of the problem, is people are so focused on petty differences, they're forgetting the responsibility to the people and what needs to be done. And so when I hear somebody like Jasmine Crockett talking truth to power, when I hear people like my classmate, Raphael Warnock, senator, talking about what we need to do as a society, that gives me hope that people are going to go ahead and focus in on that, and people are going to go ahead and leave some of the trappings behind to focus on the issues that actually affect everyday people.
Amanda, what do you think?
Yeah, when I was out canvassing this fall, I mean, that was, you know, one of my main, you know, perspectives that I would share with folks, the frustration with the dysfunction at Minneapolis City Hall. And, you know, I do think, like, we do have strong mayor, and Mayor Fry is the executive. And I am, you know, will continue to be open and hopeful that we can have some more collaboration, because I really agree, like, the job of that office and the city council is to govern, is to move our city forward. That couldn't be more critical than right now. And so I think people really need to see that happen. And that's one of the main reasons that I chose, you know, personally, and I think our member leaders chose, to support a candidate other than Mayor Fry, is that level of dysfunction for the last 8 years that has felt like our city has been really stuck. And so I think it's going to take all of us to, you know, to fight to protect our neighbors in these coming years. But I really put a lot of responsibility on our mayor to lead that.
Listen, Amanda and Corey, thank you guys both for being here, for what you do. Final comments. I want to spend the last 5 minutes with Jonathan on some other business here. But Corey, any suggestions or recommendations people to pay attention to?
No. I think right now, I just think people stay vigilant and just don't fall asleep. Because that's what they want us to do. So just make sure that you keep your head on the swivel and realize that, you know, that administration's coming after us. So to just make sure that we're ready for it.
And what do we have to do, particularly as African Americans, as Black people, Corey? How do we make sure that our voices and our interests stay in front of us and in front of the public at all times? What do you think?
You know, I mean, and I think Jonathan hit on this. I mean, all of this starts locally, and we just have to really make sure that locally that we're staying engaged and involved in what's going on with our local politics, our local mayors, our city council. Most of this is just making sure that our people are being fed, right? So they're ready to grow. And we're coming into a midterm election, which should be very interesting for people of color when it comes to trying to vote around the country. We're going to look at gerrymandered districts all over the country where they're going to do their best to try to put us into little pockets. And we just got to really make sure that we are turning out, we're showing up, we're being loud out there, and we're making sure that our presence is being felt as Black people, as brown people, as you know what, as just citizens in this country. Because at this point, saying that seems like it's a stretch when we have a man who's trying to become a king.
Amanda, how do we avoid the communities that we represent turning on each other? You mentioned that your dad and mom are from Mexico and Nicaragua. I'm a first generation American as well. My father is Cuban born, but of Jamaican extraction. I call myself an African in the New World. So I sort of claim that, and I kind of rock with that more expansive. But a lot of my friends use the language about FBA, Foundational Black Americans, and ADOS, African descendants of slavery. I fit in both camps, all camps. And so what do we do to eliminate the likelihood of us turning on each other or being exploited? The difference is exploited in ways that prevent forward movement. What do you think?
I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, key outcomes of the kind of work that organizations like Take Action Minnesota do. You know, we're sitting down and having coffee and having conversations like these around kitchen tables and asking deeper questions and getting to know, you know, not just what people think about politics, but where does that come from? And what's your experience been with that? And what is life like for you? What's hard for you? What's making you angry? You know, what are your hopes and dreams for your kids? I mean, that is the, you know, the core of organizing. And it's critical because it not only, you know, it's not only from that that we can define issues and go on to, you know, develop campaigns, but it is the thing that that shields us from the divide and conquer strategies of our opposition when we get in real relationship with each other. So I would just encourage folks, you know, you're certainly welcome to get involved to Take Action, but, you know, not just Take Action. There are many, you know, power organizations like ours. And Twin Cities is rich with power organizations. And so find a spot to be your political home and to build that community with and you know, to be able to be connected in community as you do the looking to local politics and staying vigilant. You know, there's a lot of forces trying to isolate us and divide us. And so we've got to actually find that space to come together and do it together.
Amanda Otero, thank you so much. Corey Day, thank you. We'll talk to you both later on. Thanks a lot for being here. Keep up the good work. Jonathan, the last couple of minutes here, just wanted to ask you, and we can do a program on this later on with some of your colleagues, but you had this project called Confluence. Is it Confluence Convention?
Confluence, yes.
Confluence. Tell me about that. What was that? It was last month. What was it? And it kind of fits into what we're talking about now as well.
Yes. In a certain way. Well, because the Confluence, their whole mission is building creative and inclusive and liberating spaces for BIPOC nerds, you know, basically trying to find a place where they can feel connected and inspired and be free and just dive into their fandoms. It's a two-day event. It celebrates art, sci-fi, futurism, fantasy-centered things. They had some great guests in this year. They had Yatasha Womack, who is from the Atlanta University Center. She's right there, at a graduate out of there, so one of our HBCU people. But they had, she's one of the foremost people on Afrofuturism. And it was great to have her. They had Tim Russ. He was Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, a whole bunch of other ones that are great people, wonderful local celebrities as well as national ones. And it was an opportunity for people to just kind of come together. I got to go over there. You know, I do cosplay, so I did my Mr. Terrific outfit, which is very popular since the Superman movie. But there were artists there, there were writers, there were crafts. They had a little shop, like a dealer's room where people could sell their crafts and their wares and be able to share that out. You had a lot of really great energy in the space, which was really fun. And the most of it is the ability to come together. So it's every other year, so it's biannual. So the next one will be in 2027, but they'll do pop-up stuff all through 2026. And so I'll make sure we get Leslie and a couple others back. But it's confluencemn.com if you want to follow their website and check out the things that are on there.
And so take a minute to describe what the concept of Afrofuturism is. What does it mean? It's exciting. How do we and are we getting that into the everyday vocabulary of our communities?
Afrofuturism is, I would definitely say it's coming in, you know, if nothing else, you know, through Black Panther. But it's a cultural aesthetic that blends science fiction and fantasy as well as history to reimagine the future from a Black perspective, you know, explores themes of technology and liberation and identity. So you saw a lot of that in Black Panther. You saw what would have happened if the transatlantic slave trade had never happened. I mean, that's what Wakanda represented. But you also see it in people's visions of what can the future look like with Black liberation, Black people at the forefront. so much of history we've been written out of. I think Jordan Peele's got a new movie coming out about black cowboys and about how the fact that cowboys wouldn't exist if it wasn't for them. That, you know, a third of the cowboys were black, but like you don't see them in any of the movies. They're not in the history books. There's so many pieces where we've been wiped away. So Afrofuturism takes that on into the future and says, if this stuff hadn't happened or if we had gone in a different path, here's what the future would look like. And you see much more of the creative energy. You see much more of the heritage and history coming through in